This is Daria Brzezinski with Children Come First, Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and today we have a very, very special guest, Senator James Rhodes. This is Children Come First and all about children, and Senator James Rhodes happens to be an educator himself. He received a bachelor's degree from East Stroudsburg University and a master's degree in education at Lehigh University. He's been a teacher and a coach and a principal, so he has a great deal of hands-on experiences
in education, as well as
Senator Rhodes is on the Education Policy Committee. And we're going to talk to him today a little bit about some of the issues regarding children. And I'd like to start with the new tax reform. I noticed all of the hearings that you've been doing across the state of Pennsylvania. And one of the most outstanding, I think,
equitable
and fair things in education is not the way schools are being taxed today. It seems that the formula, if there is a formula in Pennsylvania, I'm not quite sure that there is or not, it just seems to vary everywhere. And poor schools tend to have the students who aren't capable of a better education, and it seems like the wheel just keeps going on and on and on.
What are you working towards in terms of tax reform?
Well, the initiative we took, and I'll say it's been a while coming, is from the standpoint of, and I don't want to say it's tax reform, it's really a tax shift, but we would move from the property tax, which is inequitable, okay? I mean, if you look at market value, and we'll find out in poor school districts, they don't have the market value, and yet they have to tax higher because they don't have the value just to be able to get, shall we say, the minimum activities in for their students, boys and girls that need it. And as you said, too, what holds true, and we've seen research that shows that, if the money isn't there, in most cases, the opportunities for those boys and girls aren't there, haven't been there, so they usually need even that much more to be able to get up to those that have it. What our distribution formula would do, we would move into a four-tier system. And would take the median actual instructional expense, which this year would be $5,224. And in Tier 1, you take 80% of that $5,224 and multiply it by every student you have. So that there would be total equity across the Commonwealth. It wouldn't be a matter whether you're urban, suburban, or rural, but everybody gets that amount. Whether you're rich or poor, everyone gets that amount. Well, the other thing about that, too, it also deals with those districts. I think we have 67 districts want to come together in a growth suit against the Commonwealth because they're growing and the formula doesn't take account that, you know, they have more students coming into the system. This would, again, address that particular issue. The other issue, too, is by using the median, as the cost goes up, we will tend to fund at that particular level. Right now we're reimbursing maybe about $2,700 per unit, when the actual cost, as I said, in median is $5,224. So you see the difference that exists in there. Where does that difference have to come from? It has to come from the local taxpayers. Well, if I don't have it, I can't do it. And that begins to create a problem. I mean, I put it this way, the threshold has been reached, I think, as far as taxpayers are concerned as to how much they can pay or are willing to pay. And that creates, I think, an awful lot of problems, not only education-wise, but in terms of morale and attitude that exists in a community. So our effort is to go around doing that. The second part of the formula, Tier 2, deals with your aid ratio, which means those poor districts have to do a match just the same as the rich do. But it will be, shall we say, inversely proportional. So if you have a high aid ratio, you'll pay less. If you have a low aid ratio, of course, you'll have to put more in. The third deals with what we'll say the difficulty of education. Dr. Cooley out at the University of Pitt, and I know there's some others, but at least we're following his model, where we have single parents, where we have an educational level that's limited, where we don't have high school diplomas, and where we have poverty, we found out that the job gets tougher in those areas. So if we put an index together in that formula that says, you know, where there is a high uneducated area, where there is poverty, where there are single parents, you'll get more money for your educational effort that you have to put in because you need that much more. And of course, the fourth tier is if you want to add more than what the state would give you through tier one, two, and three, you can go on and add that much more to it. The other thing is what it does is it shifts the responsibility from the local back to the state. And I, you know, I've got to the point now that I don't think we have much of a choice to do that anymore. I think we have to start moving in. If, you know, if we're responsible for a thorough and efficient system, this is the way the Commonwealth does it. Now, we're looking to add, I'll say, 2 percentage points onto the personal income tax right now, and that would, on an average, reduce school district taxes by approximately 70% across the Commonwealth. For some, it'll be more. For some, it'll be less. But I think that'd be quite significant. We'd be funding at that particular level. It's the Commonwealth saying, you know, we're going to make all things equal. You know, if you want to talk about PSSA scores, if I don't have the money, I don't have the scores. If I do have the money, I do have the scores. Well, now we're going to say we're going to have the money so that everyone should have the scores.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So this is a four-tier system. Everyone will receive a minimum of 5224.
80% of that.
80% of 5224. And then there are other factors, the aid ratio.
Okay, tier two comes to the aid ratio. Okay, the two tier is the other 20%. Okay, so tier one is 80%, tier two is 20%, which makes up the 100%. Remember we're dealing with median, so it could be higher and could be lower.
Second thing is we're dealing in the second tier with your aid ratio. So that, again, is if you have money, you'll be able to, you're not going to get as much. If you don't have money, you will get more.
And then by the time you get to the fourth tier, if the district chooses to up the property taxes in order to better education in their area, that's their choice. But in other words, we're starting at a base where everyone is equitable. And it sounds very, very.
The other thing I found out, too, one of the other things in terms of, you know, they always say money isn't the answer. And I have a tendency to agree with that, but a unique thing about this is, as much as the administration say money isn't the answer, when we did empowerment, they put $33 million in there. So if it isn't the answer, why are we putting it there? The second thing we found out through research has shown us that for those districts that are below the median, when more money is put in, their students do come up to the median in terms of scores. There isn't what you'd call a significant growth or a statistically significant growth beyond the median above when you're putting more money in. But for those districts that are below, putting more money in can begin to make a difference. And so, you know, I think across the Commonwealth we're going to do it for rural districts, for urban districts, for suburban districts, and they're all that are, they need some help in there somewhere along the line.
What are your feelings about the new Empowerment Act?
From the issue of accountability, I've always been, you know, my 3 points have always been the standards, the assessment, and accountability. I think the empowerment is one of the ways of addressing accountability. My only thing is that
I would have rather flow into the system
and use the system to correct itself. I don't look at being punitive as being the answer to this. It doesn't get you results. I mean, you got to look at the problem and define the problem. And that's one thing I don't think has been done. We're looking at scores right now. Those are not always indicative of what happened. I said that on the floor when this was debated. I think it was Cleveland was one area where when they came back, the first thing they didn't go into the schools. They went to the local government and they went into economic development because they knew they had to change the environment from which these children came in. You know, if I've got a high unemployment rate, if I don't have an educational level, if I don't have the, shall we say, safe environment around my home or in my neighborhood, what's going to happen in the school? I mean, you know, the school, you know, you don't put a wall up there and, you know, you exist in a school one way and you exist in the community another. A school is a reflection of its community, always has been. And so my thing is to look at the community, see what things have to be done there. Likewise, too, even though we've defined 11 districts, you can't tell me that there aren't other children across the 501 districts that are not part of that 50% right now. So I'm more to the point of going into every district identifying where the problems are, and then working from there. And not from a standpoint of being critical or pointing fingers, but saying, you know, what is the problem here? How do we go about solving this? Our reading score is low. Well, what are we going to do about that? Our math score is low. What are we going to do about that? And working with the people and providing assistance from the state level with expertise, either in the system or from outside the system, to go in and start giving them some suggestions. Very similar to what's going on. The only thing is, it's like I'm not holding, shall we say, a sword over your head, okay? The other thing, too, we're finding out more, even in the Gallup poll that was done for Phi Delta Kappa, people are not buying into a single score or a standardized test as the total measurement of whether a child learns or does not learn. And I think we have to look at that in terms of, well, number one, with standards, we know what they should be taught. Two, the assessment should be an instrument. And I'll use the test, but I'll also use a portfolio. I'll also use the teacher's results. And I want to measure the kids to see if they're there or they're not there, whether achieving or not achieving. But I think if we got into that mode, we'd probably get more done and we'd probably get a better result and would have everybody pulling on the rope instead of a tug of war in the process.
Very, very excellent, point of view. One of the things that I noticed here is that there,
in your tier distribution,
there was no mention of special education. Is there something that's really, I noticed that the federal government tends to mandate legislation without proper funding to go along with it. What happens in this with regard to special education?
We do not address the special ed formula in the, I'll say, basic distribution. I think that something has to be done separately as far as it goes. Some states have. You know, they've done their formula. They built special education right into it. I think we have to take a whole new look at our system. The unfortunate thing is this. IDEA 97 is federal legislation. It's come down, and they've given us the rules and regulations in March of 99, which told us this is what it is. What's unique about this is I think there's 100-and-some pages in IDEA 97, 52-page appendix as to what the regulations are. And I think somebody said 200, but when I looked at it and pulled it off the Internet, it was like 2 inches of paper on what the regulations are. I don't know who's read them. I don't know where it runs. But I guess I'm going to say this is if the federal government can give me those rules and regulations, then I think they also have an obligation to put the money on the table. Right now, and I get different numbers, anywhere from 8%
up to 10 to 12%.
Even they say they should be funding us around 40%. Now, they don't lock it in that they should fund us at 40%, but they're saying, well, we should give 40%. If they did that in the Commonwealth right now, that would generate around $400 million to $500 million to us, okay? Now,
just imagine what that money could do
for special education across the Commonwealth. One of the big problems we're running into, and we hear the complaint continuously, is I can't afford the special education program. And therefore, you know, that's one of the things that forces the taxes to go up, forces other programs to be cut back on or
diminished or done away with
so that I can pay for my special education cost. I don't want to deny any child, whether they're special education or regular classroom child, the opportunity. Somewhere along the line, there has to be a balance. And I think if the feds want to give us the rules, they also should give us the money. And I think if they did that, that could solve a lot of problems and maybe even do away with some of the animosity that develops
in terms of the fighting back and forth between
the special education interest and the regular educators who are trying to balance a budget in the process.
How is the funding for special education? Is there any funding for special education in the state of Pennsylvania, or is it merely just federal funding?
Oh, no. There's significant dollars right now that comes from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
As I said, the feds only make up 8, 10, 12%
of it. The rest of it is coming from the Commonwealth. I'll say in 91, 92, we were paying excess costs, which at that time was running us probably about 100 to 125 million. In terms that was basically transferred back to the local districts so that they're making up. And
I don't have an exact number on it, but I'll say this.
Since that time, the number of students in special education has increased. The cost have increased. So where we're talking about 100 to 125 million, it's much, much more significant than that. And so that's being made up at the local level more so now than it was at any other particular time. And we hear about it. And I've got to say this. Just this year, the governor put in $32 million additional funding, okay? And we're in the multi-hundred million dollar range of reimbursement from the state. Governor put in, I think it was 32. We came back as a General Assembly and asked for an additional $17 million, okay? Matter of fact, the Representative Stairs and Senator Tomlinson have the
what we call the Stairs-Tomlinson bill in,
which was said we would fund special education at 50% level for all districts. That would cost the Commonwealth around $250 million right now. So you can begin to see the numbers there. If 50% needs another $250 million, begins to tell you how much we are putting in
and how much the locals are putting in at this time. Now, when you compare that to what the feds are doing,
they're not living up to their end of the deal, and they're the ones that really should be.
This seems like an astronomical amount of money in terms of, you know, what is the percentage of special ed children per, quote unquote, normal children in the state? I mean, it seems to me that this amount of money, I mean, funding it for a few children, and I'm not trying to be derogatory about special needs children, but it seems to me that the balance here is way out of line. And as you said earlier, are we going with mandates, or are we going out of fear in terms of all of the programs that we're providing? I mean, who has read all of the mandates, and do we really know, or are we just doing things? I mean, I know that I've heard from superintendents they can spend up to $100,000 just in litigation alone.
I think basically it's a fear of the mandates, and I think what they're being used, and I've got to say this, the special education advocacy groups are very well prepared.
When they go in, they know what to ask for,
and they're going to drive what they ask for. And in many cases, those costs, if I have to have a wraparound assistant, you know, that can cost an extra $25,000 just in terms of one person being with
the special education student.
The other thing in terms of cost, special placements could run you up to $100,000. I mean, we have cases of that.
And if you don't have it in the budget, I mean, this is one of the complaints
that I hear from superintendents on the borders. We have people from New York or New Jersey move in, and when they do, they bring with them their special education cost. And if I don't have it planned in my budget, let me say I get two or three students, that can be
$200,000 or $300,000
right then and there that I need. Now, maybe that might be an extra mill in some districts.
In my old district, that would be about three or four mills. So that begins to create a problem, and I think somewhere along the line we have to get a better handle on it, a better feed on it.
It's one of the things that exists in education right now. It's one of the things we have to address. Everything is trying to be, shall we say, in the least restrictive environment and inclusion.
Don't have problems with that.
But it's from the standpoint of, you know, how well is that student going to prosper from and grow
because of that activity?
And you know, we got to look at those. And parents will say, I want this, I want that. Sometimes, in some cases, the school has to provide services that are beyond really the school's realm or responsibility because it's demanded as part of the IEP.
And when that happens, it creates a problem. And it creates some of the, shall we say, I won't say the animosity, but the problems that exist within the district and special education services. And when it costs that money, that's when people start to complain.
If there was plenty of money around, people probably wouldn't complain. But when it starts squeezing the budget and causes some other problems, then people get upset.
Sounds almost like it's a catch-22 for politicians, because it would be political suicide to try and do something against it. And and we all recognize, anyone who knows anything about education and what's happening there, that something has to be done. You're listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Senator James Rhodes from the Pennsylvania House Education Committee.
Senator
I'm sorry, Senate Education Committee.
I get them confused constantly. You may reach us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Now, we are talking about education on many different issues, and I want to get to preschool. We were talking about school-age children, but
there, many years ago, there was a Head Start bill,
many years ago, and there have been previous supplemental programs with regard to Head Start. What is happening in the state of Pennsylvania with regard to Head Start? I know that in many districts, Pennsylvania, I don't think people realize, is generally very rural.
You have pockets of,
you know, Pittsburgh and Harrisburg and along the edges, but for the most part in between, it's a very rural area. What are you doing in terms of Head Start in terms of the state of Pennsylvania?
Probably one of the most successful programs we had that came out of the 60s was the Head Start program. I remember being with them when they celebrated their 25th anniversary.
One of the things we found out is that the young boys and girls who get a chance to get into Head Start, when we follow them through, they are successful. They get they're successful in school. They're successful afterwards because they find their occupation or training they want to get into. The second thing we found out, too, is that in many cases, their parents are successful with them. In some cases, the parents don't have a high school diploma. Well, they go back and get their GED.
They go on and take some, say, community college credits or some college credits and get themselves an associate degree or get some training and end up as Head Start teachers themselves. So the whole program has been successful. I think this year, and I have to double back and check, I know we were talking about it, but I think this was the first year that the state has put some money into the Head Start program.
Okay, at least we've been talking. I've been trying to do that
for almost the 20 years I've been here, at least 15 of the 20 years, and have never gotten the bite. It's always like it's a federal program, let the feds put the money in. One of the key things I think we find out, not only Head Start, but I think any preschool activity, any pre-kindergarten activity, is necessary for the boys and girls today.
You know, we do some testing going into kindergarten now to say whether the kids are ready for kindergarten.
If we do something, I'm big on parental involvement, and let me tie that into Head Start.
If I'm out working with parents
and we're doing reading to our kids, we're exposing them to the music, we're giving them a chance to write and do all those things, they're going to learn their ABCs, they're going to know their name,
they're going to be able to tie their shoes. Those are all positive things to do.
If I got to wait till they're in kindergarten, they are in many cases behind. And that becomes what I'll say, remedial education, or can end up leading into special education.
That's why I think the early intervention program,
any of our preschool programs, even a good effective
kindergarten to three program,
I'm still saying because the kids are young at that particular time, any of those activities are good. To me, parental involvement, and another number of programs have been put on place where school districts work with parents. When the child is born, someone from the school district goes, sees the parents and talks to them, gives them some books
to read, and tells them what to expect and what they should be doing for their child.
I think part of that,
too, is not only just the learning, but it's also the health care.
Because if that child's undernourished or has a
seeing problem or a hearing problem
or a physiological problem, that ends up retarding their learning or their ability to learn. And so I think, you know, we have to be in a position to look at this and find out. I mean, you know, the other thing, too, is it's coming on in maybe the past 10 years. We're now doing a lot of
brain research.
We're now saying that, you know, it's between 0 and 5 that the brain is most receptive to learning. So that's where we should be making sure that
those opportunities are there.
Because as that starts to close, we're missing a golden opportunity. And so I think the state, working with intermediate units, working with agencies, working with school districts, hopefully we could be able to work with parents
to help the kids out for all the preschool activities,
early childhood activities we could.
I know we're talking about issues that, believe it or not, many of my listening audience doesn't know what we're talking about. And I just thought about it as we were speaking. Many people don't know what Head Start is. Can you give them a little bit of a description of what Head Start is in the event
that they have it in their neighborhoods?
Because what I found is many of the poor communities somehow don't get the information that they need. So perhaps they might be in the listening audience. Would you tell them what Head Start is?
Probably have to get the book out to be able to read through it all.
Basically, I'll say the Head Start program is for low-income families. And I'm going to say
age-wise, I would say it's up to
birth to kindergarten age, somewhere in that particular area.
I know it includes academics.
I know it includes nutrition. I know it includes health. I would say if anyone's interested, go to your phone book. There has to be a Head Start listing in there, either in your local community, at your county level. And if you call them, they could tell you where the closest,
shall we say,
facility or training site would be. I know in my home area, it's a county run. And so they move, you know, we do bus services.
To put the get the boys and girls on the bus and drive them to all where the Head Start centers are.
And it's, to me, it's almost like a kindergarten, okay, but it's a kindergarten
for young kids. And they just do everything from the standpoint of
health services for them.
To reading, to lunches,
to games, to play periods. It's just a positive activity. And they work with the parents at the same time. So they're training the parents and the kids so that they're
successful. But anyone wants to get into it,
I'm sure you just look in the phone book, you'll see Head Start, and look under federal government, look under state government, look under your intermediate units. I know it has to be there somewhere.
Another question people ask me is, what are the functions and what is an intermediate unit and why do we have them? Could you give us an explanation of that?
They go back, I guess, towards the 60s sometime. There's 29 intermediate units right now. And they, in essence, serve the school districts in a particular locale. I come out of Schuylkill County, so my intermediate unit is all of
Schuylkill County. I also serve
Carbon County, and Carbon and Lehigh County come together in their intermediate unit. But I also serve part of Monroe County, but they're tied in with Northampton, and that's the Colonial Northampton IU. Philadelphia has its own intermediate unit. Luzerne has an intermediate unit. I mean, there's 29 of them out there. And what they, in essence, do, provide the services where the schools can
come together, and instead of,
shall we say, each district having to provide the service, they find that if they come together, they can share those services. I know in our particular case, we provide special education services through our intermediate unit. Our vocational technical program is served through our intermediate unit. But there's other things to do, from computer assistance and service
to in-service activities
to
psychological testing.
I think you can run the whole gamut of activities that go on.
Put together from the standpoint of
helping districts do the things they want to do in a consortium type of manner. And where, you know, superintendents are coming together and saying, here's some concerns we have, we'd like to do this. Driver education is one. Many districts are dropping driver education because it's coming
too expensive for them. So the intermediate units have
come back and picked up, and they're offering driver education. Now, it's at a cost, not to the school.
Well, not to the school district. We get reimbursed from the state,
but to the students that are coming back, so it's still available.
Boy, what would a high school be without driver education? My goodness, my goodness.
Again, when you look at the cost and you start running into the problem again.
And districts have to start saying, well, we've got to make a choice here. And many of them have cut their driver education program.
Oh, this is scary. You were talking about parents, and you're
very much in favor of, and you're also very knowledgeable about how the brain operates, the neurosciences, and the importance between children from until the age of 5. However, schools generally don't have an impact on that age of child. How do you propose that schools meet, greet, and work with parents in the community who have children under the age of 5 so that they can have opportunities for growth and learning at that critical stage?
I think a couple things could be done. It depends
on how you want to set up programs.
I remember one time I prepared a report on parental involvement, and when I looked at it, came back
a number of the districts got in.
As I said, they had assigned a program where they had someone in the district went to the home.
When a child was born, they met with the mother and the father,
and they gave them some I won't say textbooks, but books to read to their child.
Told them what they should do health-wise.
I'd like to see a K to 12, well, maybe I should say a pre-K to 12, an early childhood all the way through the 12th grade program
with parental involvement.
First teacher that a child has are the parents.
if parents are involved with their children, the children, for the most part, are successful. As a matter of fact, research has even shown where parents are involved with their kids, even the children whose parents aren't involved do better.
So that has to tell us something, okay? Achievement-wise, attitude-wise, it's just a positive attitude all the way around. One of the things we find out is, and I think it holds true, elementary parents are usually involved with their children quite significantly.
As they get older and get into the middle school or junior high school, it drops off.
And by the time you get into the senior high, it drops off. I would tell you to take a look at the achievement scores at the elementary, middle, junior high level, and senior high level. And I'll say that there's a direct proportion between parental involvement and scores. Because when you see the math scores dropping off, it's when the parents have a tendency to drop off. When you see the reading scores drop off,
see, the parents don't. And I've said this, and I see this all the time.
Parents who stayed involved with their children, and even through senior high, those students, for the most part, are the students that do well in school, that are achieving well, have, shall we say, no psychological problems. A lot of things just balance themselves out. Where when you kind of let your children go by themselves, and you got to remember this, they're still children. We have a tendency as we get adults
to think back to when we were 10, 12, or
13, and think of that as adults instead of saying, well, what did you really think when you were 10? Cut everything out and put yourself back as a 10-year-old and look at the world as a 10-year-old, knowing what you know now. Do the same all the way through. You'll begin to appreciate more this big world that these kids look at. I mean, the thing is, now we look down at the kids, but remember when you were a child and you looked up
at somebody that was 6 foot tall and you're only
3 feet tall? It tells you something else. And I think these are the things we have to get into. I'd love to be able to see a K-12 program where we talk about children's physiological, psychological, social, and emotional development so parents recognize that. I was a principal in a intermediate school, which was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. That's where the kids are in between.
They're still children, but they want to be adults.
And so, they look at authority. They'll test the authority as an adult. But if something goes wrong, they'll start to cry. And, you have to know those things. And parents have to be able to, I think we can help parents recognize their children.
And maybe help their children and the children be able to recognize what their parents are doing.
It could be a two-way street.
You have been listening to Children Come First, and this is the conclusion of our first half hour with Senator James Rhodes. We'd like you to join us again for our second half hour. You may call us at 877-TOLL-FREE, PRO-KIDS, 877-PRO-KIDS. Please join us for our second half hour, and we'll listen to a station break.